going to get the Regulated Industries Committee started. Tapes are on. We don't have a quorum to officially start, but we'd like to get testimonies finished up from last week. Left on the agenda is Vic DeBrias from Sprint, if he wants to come forward. And then we'll get into a couple bill hearings. So, Mr. DeBrias, welcome to our committee. You can identify
yourself. Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Victor Delbrus. I represent Sprint's local telephone, long distance, and wireless communications operations. You've been provided with a copy of our position statement, but I'll just go over some highlights of the statement for you this afternoon. First of all, when it comes to voice over internet protocol services, there are many far-reaching implications for the telephone industry depending on whether those services are treated as telephony services or information services. Now, the industry in general is moving toward use of internet protocol in the long-distance network in the form of packet switching, but I should make the point that the fact that at some point during its transmission, a telephone call is converted to internet protocol does not mean that the call has become an information service instead of a telephone service. One of the major issues in the treatment of voice over IP traffic is compensation for the originating and terminating carriers. Most voice over IP calls use the traditional telephone network to terminate a long distance call, and in some cases it's used to originate the call. Where that public network is used by voice over IP traffic, it's appropriate that the VOIP carrier compensate the company that owns that network for its use. That's one of the issues that that made it attractive for Quest recently to open their VOIP trial. Is under the current treatment, they don't have to pay terminating access charges for traffic carried on their VOIP service. They, in effect, have an incentive to move as much of their long-distance traffic as they can to the Internet to avoid payment of those charges. Another major issue from a long-distance carrier's perspective is that long-distance carriers today pay approximately 9% of their revenue into the Federal Universal Service Fund to preserve local telephone service in high-cost areas of the country. Voice over IP providers do not pay into that fund, so they have an instant 9% cost advantage, and in effect, the regulatory decision gives them a competitive advantage that other technologies do not have. Another area of concern from more or less the reverse side of the equation is that the Telecom Act of 1996 does not give voice over IP providers the same rights to interconnect with telephone service providers to terminate traffic, does not give them the right to request telephone numbers from the numbering plan administrator, and does not give them the right to buy unbundled network elements from incumbent local exchange carriers to provide their service. Those rights under the Telecom Act are reserved to telecommunications service providers. There are also public safety and security issues that need to be addressed. Information service providers are not required to provide 911 services. Last Wednesday's Pioneer Press had an article with the 911 administrator here in Minnesota and various other parties expressing their concerns over whether and how 911 traffic could be completed and terminated for voice over IP customers. There is a public security issue in the form of compliance with the CALEA requirements. The CALEA is the Communications Act for Law Enforcement Assistance of 1994. That federal law requires telephone companies to assist law enforcement agencies in electronic surveillance of telephone calls and similar traffic pursuant to court orders or other appropriate authorization. information service providers don't have to do that. And that's a source of concern for the law enforcement community. The final area that I'll touch on is state and local taxes. Voice over IP traffic, simply because it is carried over the internet, should not be able to avoid being taxed in the same fashion as other telephone communications. It's not a question of taxing the internet. It's simply a question of taxing a service that uses the internet for some portion of its transmission. A similar example would be securities transactions. You can trade stocks over the internet, but the transactions are very heavily regulated at state and federal levels. That concludes my remarks, Mr. Chairman, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from those committee members that are here or those that aren't here? I got one question, Mr. DeBrius. Has Sprint started engaging in any voice over internet protocol?
We're not currently offering voice over internet protocol services, but as I mentioned, we are in some cases using packet switching for our conventional long distance rapid, and that technology does use internet protocol switching.
And in using that, do you still pay the access fees?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we do.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you. Thank you for holding over till this week and working with us on that as well. We appreciate your comments.
Thank you.
Okay, next, Envoy Paul Hoff. Mr. Hoff, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Hoff. I'm an industry vice president with Envoy, and I thank you and the committee for allowing me the opportunity to testify today. I was here last Tuesday and was prepared to testify in support of your House Bill 2151, depending upon the committee's interpretation of what the word immediate means, but as I was listening to the testimony in the emerging technologies area, it seemed like appropriate that maybe I comment on that as well. So with your indulgence, first thing I'll get into is House File 2151, and is that in order?
Yeah, Mr. Hoff, actually that's coming up in a little while, so maybe we should hold off on that and just have you come back when we bring that bill up.
Okay.
Would that be all right?
That's fine.
Okay.
Then what I'd like to do, if I might, listening to your conversations last week in the emerging technologies field, I was very interested to hear in the new technologies that, in fact, are being rolled out in the state of Minnesota. And I'd like the opportunity to just tell you a little bit about what we're doing. Envoy has been providing converged IP to hundreds of customers for over 2 years. We have over 100 endpoints, and at Envoy we call an endpoint a large office complex that might have multiple locations throughout the state or throughout the country, but those office complex can have as many as 200 employees in a single complex. Envoy's converged IP product, like I say, is a multi-site, high-end solution that is very cost-effective for businesses. Utilizes the private IP technology with at least one DS1 or one T1 to every end site. Envoy serves as an example affiliated community medical centers, ACMC. Prior to converting to Envoy's community centered approach, ACMC received 84 telecommunications types of bills per month to serve its 10 clinics in the state in 9 cities. Today, not only have their costs been reduced and their services enhanced, but they receive 4 bills to serve those instead of 84 bills. But what we're really most excited about is this spring we'll be rolling out a voice-over IP product through the rural telephone companies in Minnesota. And unlike the voice-over IP providers that you've heard from last week, our solution complies with all E911, CALEA, and Homeland Security standards. It's a patent-pending process or project, but it will support the continuation of universal service, your telephone assistance program, your telephone assistance or to the TASIP program, and supports all those mechanisms that are in place today. The ARVIC communication system up in Perm and the Pine Island Telephone Company in Pine Island are testing the services currently today. And I'd like to invite you, and on behalf of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, to their convention March 22nd and 23rd for a demonstration of our services. At the MTA show, and I might add, that's the largest telecommunications show, state association show in the country, you'll be amazed at the number of private vendors and technologies that are available to you today. And just like at last week's meeting, I was amazed at the technology that that British Telecom was in fact talking about, and almost like a kid in a candy store. The only caution that I would make to you is that as great as that technology can be, it's really only an expanded version of what we call in this state and what it's licensed as a cordless phone or a site type application. Applications of this type of service are terrific for difficult and ever-changing infrastructures associated with government buildings and the like. And if you can be assured of the security concerns over wireless technology, it's an excellent site replacement or a site solution. There's a couple of things that technology is not. Number one, it's not a network provider, and it must rely on an infrastructure like the telecommunications providers in the state of Minnesota provide to get from place to place, to get from Grand Rapids to St. Paul, or an example I think that was brought up to get from Wilmer to Hastings. It's also a technology that, as cutting edge as it is, or it may seem, will be replaced someday. And the state should seriously consider not to marry itself to any particular technology, especially when they've got the option to specify technologies for lease from the private sector. That concludes my remarks, Mr. Chairman, and I stand by for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hoff. Any questions from the committee? I just got one question quick. You said you were going to offer VoIP with all the universal access charges and that's being paid. What is the incentive of VoIP then? Is it, I mean, aren't you paying the same taxes, the same access fees, or is there still a cost competitive advantage?
The telephone company in our scenario will be utilized to provide the service and thereby provide its local telephone numbers and be a partner in providing the service. What they will be doing is actually offering the customer, rather than the traditional long-distance service, the IP or the network cloud method of completing calls throughout the nation. They will sell packages as they determine strategic for their areas. But it will replace their traditional long-distance service today.
Okay, expanding where people can call for free?
Exactly, and free, of course, is a relative word, almost your immediate is on your other bit. But free is based on a per-month package. Yes, those calls will be included in that free.
Okay, I'm going to just hold off right now and call the Regulated Industries Committee meeting to order. We have a quorum. Representative Westerberg moves the approval of the minutes from last Wednesday, February.
So moved, Chair.
February 18th. Any discussion or changes to the minutes? All those in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. Sorry, Mr. Hoff. Representative Westerberg had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hoff, as far as in understanding voice over the Internet protocol, can you tell me the different ways that that can be used? I mean, as far as communicated to the different locations? In other words, can this be done wireless over landlines? I notice here you're doing it on fiber optic lines. What are the numbers, different numbers of ways that you can communicate with voice over the Internet?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, most technologies will afford themselves of an IP type of transport medium, but for the most part, the IP solutions that are being brought to the public today are of the wired nature. But it is my belief, and I think British Telecom testified last week that they certainly are expanding their end or their solution for, I think they mentioned the Red Wing Correctional Institution and so forth, that in fact that would carry IP solutions. So it can almost go through any medium.
Satellite.
And it's basically a rather than a voice over a wire. A physical wire. It rides a carrier within that wire and its packets.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hoff. I actually, talking with Brian up here, I've changed my mind. Why don't you want to just offer comments on that bill while you're here? That way,
I appreciate that.
That helps. It's more convenient for yourself as well. And if questions come up, we can call you back if you're still around. But
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. I just want to reiterate, though, I was serious about the MTA convention. It's at the Hyatt, March 22nd, 23rd. You're all invited. The MTA office can send you invitations, but you're welcome to come down and play with the technology and make calls to your relatives in California or whatever that don't cost you anything, and just check out the quality.
Feel free to forward either an email invitation to us, the committee members, and we can see that they get them.
We'll do that.
Or send each one directly, however you want.
We'll do that.
Okay. Now, committee members, what Mr. Hoff's going to just briefly talk about is House File 2151 with his support or perspective on it. And that's coming up later, but being he's here, I'll just let him make his testimony, and then we'll move on with the first bill of the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee. As you can see from the handout, Envoy has an operator services center in Chicago, Minnesota, and that services center handles about directory assistance calls for 600,000 access lines both in Minnesota and Iowa. Our operators handle about 500 calls a day out of that center, and that center is backed up by some positions in our corporate office in Plymouth. Although I might add that we're nearing capacity in the Chicago Center, and we will be looking to expand that center or find another backup center in another rural community in Minnesota. House File 2151 mandates immediate credit be available to customers that call into that center because of faulty information and the like. At Envoy, we did not provide or the ability for that operator to, in fact, give immediate credit because our folks tell me that out of those 500 calls a day or 15,000 calls a month, we only get about two such requests a month. And in checking with the telephone companies that serve the state of Minnesota, they tell me that most of those credit requests go directly to their business offices and not to the operator services center. But since that time, we have implemented a system whereby the operators will get on a LAN and they will notify our billing department that when they issue the bill through the telephone company, that not only the charge for that call will be on the call, but the operator-initiated credit will be on the customer statement as well. My first inclination was, in fact, when I heard of this, to just have a keystroke in the operator services center that would wipe out that charge. But my managers tell me that, in fact, if you don't have the charge and the credit on the bill that they can see, that the customer can see, that there would be validation questions and we'd probably go through more gyrations, and I guess I submit to their knowledge of the customers, and so that's kind of the way we do it. So if that meets the terms of the bill, which say immediate, we would support we would support this legislation. And I could mention, and I don't think Victor Dobris from Sprint, I think they're going down the same path, is giving that kind of credit to the customer that will show up on the statement. We'll even try to automate it in the future, but as such, we're not done with the programming yet. But with that, that concludes the testimony. If there are questions, I stand ready to answer them.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Hoff. And
thank you, Chair.
We'll look forward to more in the future. With that, we're going to move House File 1743, the first one on the agenda. I'm going to turn the chair over to the vice chair and just present from here. But actually, Representative Westerberg, I'll let you.
Okay. We will find the next bill is going to be 1743. And would you like to move the bill?
I will.
Representative? Westrom, Chair, moves House File 1743. Would you like to proceed with the testimony?
Well, Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm actually going to call Tracy Bridge from CenterPoint Energy up to do the more detailed explanation. But essentially, this bill just deals with a sunset that was put in law about 8-10 years ago for an option for the gas companies and to use. To my knowledge, it hasn't been used, but they would like to have the tool as an option if they would so choose. And the bill gets rid of the sunset completely. I have expressed some interest in maybe putting some extended sunset in place, but it's really not a big deal either way, and so I would defer to committee members if they think that would be a good policy to bring it back 10 years or whatever and look at. But
okay, Mr. Chair Westrom, I notice that there is a DE1 amendment in the delete all in the file here. Are you?
I'll move that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the DE1 delete all amendment has been moved. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Do you want to speak to the amendment first?
Let's just get it in the shape, and then Tracy can talk.
Seeing no discussion on the amendment, all those signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
The amendment passes.
So with that, why don't I let Mr. Bridge explain their concern for the bill.
Mr. Bridge, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Tracy Bridge. I represent CenterPoint Energy Minnegasco, based in Minneapolis. I appreciate the opportunity to speak in favor of the Delete All Amendment. As the chairman indicated, this is a concept that's been in place since 1997. It was a concept that was developed collaboratively, both with the gas utilities and the state agencies that regulate us. It is an option, a voluntary option, both for utilities and for the regulators to look at in improving efficiency while maintaining or improving service for natural gas customers in Minnesota. This delete all amendment does four things very simply, and it's a technical amendment from my standpoint. We've worked with the Attorney General's Office, the Department of Commerce, the Public Utilities Commission, and the other natural gas utilities, and to my knowledge, no one opposes this delete all amendment. But very briefly, as a Chair Westrom indicated, it removes the current sunset from the statute that enables the Public Utilities Commission to approve performance-based regulation plans upon the findings that are set forth in the statute. The current sunset would have the authorization come off the books January 1, 2006. This amendment removes that sunset. In addition, it does three other things. First, it adds the word materially to the purpose section of the statute, which requires that prior to the Public Utilities Commission approving such a plan, they would have to be satisfied that customer rates would be materially lower than they would be under traditional cost-based regulation. Second, primarily at the request of the Office of Attorney General, there is one criterion that exists in the statute that the PUC would have had to find otherwise prior to approving such a plan, and that is that a plan such as this be compatible with increased competition in the natural gas industry. This was put in place in 1997 when all of us were expecting more retail competition, and California came along and Enron came along, and there isn't any more anticipation of expanding retail competition from my standpoint, and we all agreed that this was unnecessary language, and this amendment deletes that language. And then finally, it extends the date for the Public Utilities Commission to make an evaluation report and to file it with the legislature, extends that date from January 1, 2005 until January 1, 2012. And the purpose of that is simply to allow more time for there to be experience with this statute and with these plans, and then report back to the legislature. And, Mr. Chair, I would submit that in lieu of putting a sunset on this statute at this point, that the legislature will have ample notice and opportunity once it receives this report by 2012 to reconsider whether this is a statute that is and continues to be good public policy. So that would certainly be an option in lieu of just extending the sunset. We would certainly prefer that the sunset come off and that the legislature have the opportunity to reconsider that once the report is filed no later than 2012. I'll be happy to stand for questions. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you. Because I messed up on his name before, I have to do it a little differently. The one, the only, Representative Sheldon Johnson.
Well done, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, what does the word materially mean in the delete all manner? What is that as opposed to just having it said lower? What does material mean?
Mr. Bridge.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. The purpose of that one-word addition in the purpose section of the enabling statute was to make the purpose section compatible with the standard that is provided for a little bit later in that same statute, which requires as one of the criteria that the Public Utilities Commission must find that rates would be materially lower under this alternative form of regulation than under the traditional cost-of-service-based regulation. And the word material, albeit a little bit subjective, not particularly quantified in the statute, is intended to mean everybody agrees that they don't want to see filings that would be at the margin, that would be so minimal that it would be a regulatory and administrative waste of time. It needs to be a substantial material reduction compared to what rates would have been otherwise.
Okay, any further questions or comments? Okay, well, thank you for your testimony. Do you have another testifier?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Westman.
Mr. Bridge, I just want to verify for the committee, this amendment, is that compatible with what the Senate approved, and where is it at in the Senate?
Mr.
Chairman, Representative, it is identical to what is going through the Senate yesterday afternoon. The Senate Energy Committee, and that's not the exact name, Senator Anderson's committee, passed this exact language and put it on the consent calendar, which would be an option that we would be delighted to see in the House as well.
Representative Westrom?
That's all.
Okay. Any further questions or comments? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Okay, and seeing no one, Mr. Representative. Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'd like to renew my motion and recommend this bill to pass and be placed on the consent calendar.
Representative Westrom renews his motion to pass House File 1743 and send it to the consent calendar. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. It passes. Congratulations.
Well, that was quick. Next, we're going to bring up House File 1692, Representative Vanderveer. Representative Vanderveer, welcome to the committee. If if you can tell us about your bill and bring forth your testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1692, first of all, I have a couple of amendments I'd like to put on the bill to get it in the shape that I would like it in. And the first one would be the A1 amendment, and it's a technical amendment affecting that deals with the effective date.
The chair will move the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Tell us what it just deals with the effective date.
The effective date and stating that the contract is the customer's contract, so it's a technical clarifying amendment.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Amendment passes.
Thank you. I have a brief verbal amendment I'd like to move, and that's on page 2, line 4, after the period, insert, a provider must maintain verification of the customer that the customer accepted the terms of the contract for the duration of the contract period.
Where are you?
Go ahead.
That's in writing?
Yes.
Why don't you repeat it so Mr. Eloff and Kathy can have it.
Page 2, line 4, after the period, insert, a provider must maintain verification that the customer accepted the terms of the contract for the duration of the contract period.
At the end, you said period. Is that the word period or a period?
The word period.
So yeah, period. Period,
period.
Period. Okay. Mr. Eloff, do you have that? Do you want to repeat that for the committee?
A provider must maintain verification that the customer accepted the terms of the contract for the duration of the contract period.
Everyone have that? All those, any discussion? All those in favor of the verbal amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Amendment passes. Mr. Representative Vanderveer, should be in the shape you want it.
It is. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What the bill does is simply require that customers receive and agree to a contract from a provider, a cell phone provider. And number two requires that the provider make a substantial, if the provider makes a substantial change in the service that they are providing, they allow the customer to opt out of the contract. So it's a simple bill. It does provide some penalties for failing to do that. And the purpose of the bill is to simply ensure that consumers are aware of the fact that they're entering into a long-term contract with their providers and to allow them out of the contract if the service level changes substantially. So a simple bill and pretty straightforward. And I do have a witness, Mr. Chair, up here.
Okay, go ahead.
My name is John Povejsil, P-O-V-E-J-S-I-L. I'm a resident of Forest Lake. I am an attorney up there and also a small business owner, father with 3 kids, and married. Last year about this time, I added a cell phone to the plan that I had in place, and I had chosen plan that I was using and been subscribed for about 7 years, and the main reason I had chosen this particular company was they allowed you to go month to month without long-term contracts. You pay a substantial price for their equipment, but in return you get the option to go month to month. Mainly because of family considerations, I like the flexibility that offers. When I added this phone, apparently there was a substantial amendment to the contract where I was no longer in a month-to-month deal, but a year-long contract. When I no longer needed that extra cell phone as part of my basic plan and tried to terminate it, I was informed at that point that I was in a one-year contract and that there was fairly hefty termination fee. And I was speaking with the company representative at the time, and they informed me that I was in a one-year contract, and I said, oh, really? Nobody ever told me that. In fact, I asked at the time of whether something like that was going to happen, and they said, well, everything is going to stay the same. You're still month to month, and here's what it's going to cost you. All that said, when it came down to terminating that particular phone line, it wasn't the case. I was in a long-term contract. I'm not sure what the cell phone companies ought to do, and I'm willing to take questions and be more specific about the particular company involved. I don't have any particular beef with the company other than that when a consumer contract is amended, I think the company ought to go to some length to let you know that that's the case. And with that, I'll yield to any questions.
Representative Junkie.
Just some curiosity questions. Who was the company?
It was Sprint.
Sprint? I know everyone in the audience want to know that, too.
so did I, Representative Junkie.
I figured that, Mr. Chair. And then second question, I just have to ask it because you're an attorney, and my attorney friends always tell me to read the small print. Was there nowhere at all, or just are you a typical consumer like I am, and I really don't read that small print anywhere? Was there no indication at all along the way, or did you sign it later on, read the yellow unlegible contract copy that you got and realized it was in there somewhere?
I have to say that my first day in law school with my contract professor, Ed Butterfuss, he said, always ignore consumer contracts. They don't mean much. He's the dean of Hamlin Law School, and I think he's a pretty good authority on consumer contracts. Not to be flip in my answer, but this was all done over the phone, and there wasn't anything to read. So I think that legitimately answers the question, that there wasn't anything to read at the time.
And, Mr. Chair, to represent Vanderveer, why just cell phones? Why not? I've often had the question. This actually happened in a community next to in my district, where they actually a different phone company had come in and taken over the exchange, and started billing everyone in town for I believe it was internet service, and they didn't have internet service. Everyone in town had a bill that came out. Ought we not make, even when you hook up for new phone service, wouldn't it be nice within 30 or 60 days to get a list of all those amenities that you supposedly signed up for and then have an opportunity to unsign up for them in case you didn't?
Representative Vanderveer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, it would be nice if you got that information, and it would be especially nice if it was binding you, which most of, I think, the service you're talking about doesn't, to a long-term agreement with the company. And I think that's one of the issues here, is that people can't get out of that service agreement. And at the time where you enter into the agreement, you have a choice of different options that you can select from different companies, and you, in effect, pass up on some in order to accept that contract with that company. So primarily, I think it's because of the long-term contract and the fact now you bring up, you know, when you bring up telephone companies, you may not be able to switch, although you can now. You may not have an option but to deal with them, and of course that's a different game too.
Just a follow-up question to that, and then Representative Powell, to the witness. Did you ever receive a paper copy of your contract, or just over the phone verification?
To tell you the truth, I'm not sure I did. I received bills, of course. I think like most people, I look at the bottom line in the bill and how much I have to pay. And in my opinion, after the fact, an after-the-fact contract doesn't really do me a whole lot of good because that's not necessarily what I agreed to. I mean, when I was on the phone with the cell phone company representative, there was no indication. I mean, maybe they taped my call, maybe I'm wrong, and I'd certainly be willing to admit that I'm wrong if they produced a tape that said, yeah, I agree to a new contract, but I'm reasonably certain that my memory is correct, that they did not tell me, oh, by the way, you're no longer a month-to-month customer, you're in a long-term contract.
Representative Powell.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the question I have is really simple. If you say you can't get out of the service contract, it sounded like to me by your story that you didn't change service contracts.
I dropped one of the phone lines that I had, and they charged a termination fee of $150 due to the fact that I was terminated before the contract became mature. And like I said, what contract? My understanding is I have a month-to-month arrangement, and you're saying I have to go to February 2004 before this $150 charge is waived. And like I said, that was the first time I was made aware that there was an actual change in terms from month-to-month to a one-year service period.
And Mr. Chairman, how long was the difference between the time that you ordered the new phone and the new service and the time you terminated? What was the time frame?
Must have been about 8 months.
And Mr. Chairman, one more.
Follow up.
And you had no indication, no mailings from the company saying that you had a change in your contract?
I can't say that I didn't, but I would say that in my opinion that would be irrelevant because it takes two to make a contract, and you know, I think if they don't tell me at the time I'm agreeing to the change in service that, oh, by the way, a substantial term has been changed to put you into a one-year contract, if that were made clear to me, I would have been in a position to reevaluate whether I wanted to continue with that company. I had a particular reason for being with Sprint in the first place. I liked the fact that you could buy your equipment and open a line or close a line without a lot of fuss. That was one of the reasons I started with them 7 years ago.
Representative Pop, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for you. If consumer contracts don't mean anything, why are we here? Isn't this irrelevant?
Are you asking me?
I'm asking you. Your law school professor, who can be trusted, said consumer contracts don't mean anything.
I think things just need to be made clear. When you're doing a business transaction over the phone, I think there have to be some indications of what you're really agreeing to. The way my memory serves me in this case is that I was adding a phone, I was agreeing to pay for a new phone and what that monthly charge was, but I absolutely didn't agree to anything in addition to that. And so if they sent me something saying after the fact that I did, that doesn't hold up to me. That's not a real contract.
Representative Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that I would add, I think the point here, there is considerable debate as to whether you actually do have a contract in this case. After talking to even lobbyists for the cell phone companies, there might be some question about that because of the way you're supposed to enter into contracts. The issue is that the consumer is being telemarketed. They make a decision on the phone, and they're frequently not given the full information that they have a contract of a specific duration. The cell phone companies will say that they are. But the question is, after that, when there's a dispute, what does the consumer do? And it's, you know, this started out in a situation with me where the phone company calls up and says they're going to start charging for call forwarding. I said, well, that's fine. I'm going to change service. And they said, no, you're not. You bought a phone in April. You're going to stay here for 2 years or a year. I said, well, what's that about? And didn't know I had a contract with them. The point, though, at that point is, what are you going to do? Are you going to get an attorney to get out and get your $175 back? And all this bill does is simply says that the provider will give you a copy of the contract, that you will affirm that you've received it and you agree with it. And I frankly don't see anything wrong with that. I think it's pretty simple and straightforward. It's clear that they're not doing that on every occasion now.
Representative Hoppe, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, if we do that, then being able to go to an existing provider and get an extension or a change in your contract will cease to exist. You won't be able to do things unless you do it in person or do it with a contract. And I'd be curious to know, sir, if you ever had to pay the $150.
I paid it just because it was too much of a hassle not to pay it.
Okay.
And I can afford to pay it. I don't like paying it.
Sure.
But what am I going to do? I can let it hang out there. I can let it show up on my credit report. In my practice, I see people who do that all the time, end up with a derogatory on their credit report. They don't have the means to deal with that. I happen to be fortunate enough that I can eat the cost, move on. But I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who aren't situated like I am, who have to spend a lot of time fighting with this. And again, and you know, I'm giving testimony as to facts, but I'll render a legal opinion. If they came into my office, I'd say, I'm not sure you do have a contract. I'm not sure you have a contractual obligation to pay this fine, but it's showing up on your credit report, and they say you do. And your only alternative here is to do a dispute process under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And for $150, you know, I'm not sure all that many people are going to fight it.
Representative Vanderveer and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the point is still the same. You act like there's no easy way to affirm it. I mean, that's kind of your assertion. You can do it on the web. The last service that I got, you just clicked. I understand that there's a long-term contract, and you know, if we accept your argument, then the company can tell you you have a contract under any terms and conditions, and what are you going to do? How would you disprove it? So some companies tape it, the agreement that you, right on the phone when you make it. Some of them require that you do it on the web, and or you could send in a written consent within the 15-day period. They could send you out the contract, you could sign it and return it. So there's any number of ways to do it, but asking for an affirmation that and showing an agreement that a contract has been made seems very reasonable if the company is going to assert on your credit report that, you know, you violated the contract with them. I think all we would ask is that they show that they have one.
So Representative Johnson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I definitely like the direction we're going with this, Representative Vanderveer. I do have a question about the PUC. Do they have the time and the staff and the interest, whatever, to determine whether violations have occurred? Have they taken a position on this?
To the witness? I forget your last name.
Vanderveer.
No,
it's him.
You asked me, Mr. Chair.
You've just promoted yourself to the witness level.
I'm provincial, and for the record, that's P-O-V-E-J-S-I-L, just like it sounds.
Provincial. Representative Vanderveer, then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I haven't discussed this with them. I haven't received an indication as to whether they thought this was a problem or not. So.
Representative Junkie.
To that point, Mr. Chair, I have that same question here. The commission is the one that's collecting and depositing. Want to be more proper with Department of Commerce? Don't they typically do more of the fines and work have groups that work with this more? I'm not disputing that you should collect the fines, but I wonder if it shouldn't be the Department of Commerce and not the PUC that's doing it.
Representative Vanderveer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, you know, we have considered that. I think it has some merit, and it's something, as we go forward, we could look at if the department cared to weigh in on it.
And certainly, Mr. Chair, the Chair of Commerce is sitting here, too, and I think it's more their purview, isn't it, for fine collection and other things?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davids.
That's correct. My opinion would be more appropriate over to Commerce. They have that function, and I don't think the PUC does, do they?
We'll work on it.
I can't testify to that.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Vanderveer, I admire the part that you asked for full disclosure in a contract. I think it's very appropriate. But at the same time, if we allow customers to get cell phone customers to get out of their contracts with the investment that the cell phone company made, let's say a cell phone, something that we just made legal last year for hardwire phones, and other costs involved in getting a person signed up, is this company going to be able to get any of those costs back, or will the ultimate result of this be that everybody pays more for their cell contract, regardless of where it is?
Representative Underver.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, I appreciate your concern there, but the only way that the customer can get out of the contract is if there's a substantial change, and we define it as increasing the cost of the service to the customer. And what that's saying is simply that you agree to a particular service plan or agreement, and if the company changes it, which this doesn't prevent them from doing, and there's been considerable discussion about whether even that's okay if it is a contract, for one side to change the condition, terms of the agreement, and the other not be able to, all we're saying is if they do change it and it costs the customer more, the customer can get out. We're not just letting them out of the contract. The company would have to make a substantial change in the service provided before that would happen.
Follow up, Representative Gilbert.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vandermeer, I think of many things that the cell phone companies as well as other businesses do as in a promotion. They give you, I remember not too long ago, Midwest Wireless said, Representative Gunther, Bob Gunther, you're going to have to spend $5 per person more to have 1,500 nighttime and weekend minutes. But when I first took the phone over, that was a promotion that they gave me. They let me know it was promotion, but many, many people thought it was something that was in their contract and it should be theirs. When they change their promotion and says, if you enjoy these minutes, then you're going to have to pay for them. Is that reason enough for me to get on my cell phone contract?
Representative Vandenberg.
No, Representative Gunther. If you were provided with a contract that told you that and you agreed to it, you would not be able to get out of the contract.
Mr. Chairman, that was not in my contract. It was not part of the deal. It was a promotion that I took advantage of. Much like when grocers say you buy a can of chop suey chow mein, you get 50 cents off. It's for this week. Yeah, not Chum King anymore. Okay. That was one of Gino's companies, by the way.
I think that if I can answer.
I'd love it.
I think that's a substantially different situation where you're getting a benefit for a certain amount of time. In my case, I was getting a detriment that they just weren't telling me about. They were saying, you know, you think you're in a month-to-month, but we're not going to tell you you're not in a month-to-month until you try to terminate. And I think there's a difference there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And actually, let me add, in my case, I paid roughly $200 for this piece of equipment. That probably isn't the full price that it costs the phone company. I accept that. But it generally is a lot more than you pay for equipment with their competitors. Sprint, as I understand it, you pay for your equipment at a much higher percentage than you do with the companies that say, we'll give you a free cell phone if you agree to a two-year contract.
Representative Hoppe, and then... Do you have another witness, Representative Vanderveer?
I don't believe so today,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not an attorney, but I have a question on the first page, line 20, subsection D, where it talks that starts with substantive charge. It says means change. Thank you. Means a modification to or addition or deletion of a term or condition in a contract that could result in an increase in the charge to the customer under that contract. The word could there, I mean, I think that leaves things open. There's a lot of things that could possibly lead to a change or an increase. I mean, that's a pretty big loophole that, you know, companies would have to deal with. They have to almost be fortune tellers to know what could one day increase charges.
Representative Vandiver? You're thinking Representative Hoppe, take the word could out, that results in...
Well, I'm not trying to nitpick, but I think...
No,
what
well,
we're
that's
doing
what we need to do with statutes.
Yeah, we're looking at things that might make things a lot harder for, you know, and if this happens with wireless companies, it could come other places. And it could happen in other areas, and I don't think we want to make this more complicated. And I don't, you know, 99% of the people don't read these anyhow. It's something where we might be nitpicking for no real good net benefit.
Representative Vandiver?
Well, Mr. Chair, they might not read them, but they are enforced upon them if they decide to change. But I think, you know, that's a good suggestion. We could scratch could and add an S to result or something. Certainly willing to talk about that, Representative.
Well, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Representative Hoppe.
Again, if you take the word could out and you add the S to results, then how can you send people a contract change ahead of time? You know, you got the same problem. You don't know that something is going to result, you know, somewhere down the road in a change that would be more money.
Well, Mr. Chair, then Representative, I guess I'm not sure why you could charge them a termination fee if you change the terms of the agreement and then said, if you don't like it, pay me. And leave. I mean, that's kind of the gist of the bill. But if you have another suggestion that would make that more clear, that's fine. But the intent is that if you didn't charge, you agreed for 2 years, you'd get free long distance, and they sent you a letter and said you don't get free long distance anymore, but your bill stays the same. I think you should at that point be able to opt out of your contract without paying an early termination fee. So what language gets to that, I think the author of the language is here. Maybe he'd have a suggestion, but he's now with a different department.
Representative Hoppe, are you suggesting an amendment or just for discussion purposes?
Just for discussion. I'll leave that up to Representative Vandiver.
Okay.
If he wants to change it.
Well, let's get more testifiers if there is.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any more people that want to speak in favor of the bill or neutral?
Neutral one. This one.
Neutral. Come forward.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Marker with the Attorney General's Office, Residential Utilities Division. I'm not quite sure how to characterize our position on the bill, whether it be neutral, but now's as good a time as any. We certainly welcome any effort by this body to protect consumers on the wireless side of the telecom business. We certainly receive a lot of complaints in our office about wireless service and items that relate to this bill as well. And we absolutely applaud any effort to clarify contract terms and to make contracts available to consumers, certainly. One of the fundamental issues that I think that we have with this bill is that we don't think it goes quite far enough as far as consumer protection is concerned. The way it is currently drafted, excuse me, if a wireless provider offers a substantial change to the terms of the contract, then the consumer then has a period of time to opt out and reject those changes. We would prefer an opt-in situation. In other words, if a wireless provider were to offer substantial change to a contract, which almost, I think, exclusively results in a rate increase for the provider or for the consumer, then we would prefer a situation whereby, unless the consumer affirmatively and specifically opts in to accept the substantial change to the contract, then the change does not occur for that consumer, and the original terms of the contract would apply. Again, these are just initial thoughts. We don't have a specific amendment to offer at this point in time, but that's a sort of fundamental concern with this bill, is that the consumer that isn't necessarily paying attention to the mailings that seem ever increasing from telecom providers, might miss a substantial change to the contract. And so our concern is that, again, the consumer is the other party to this contract, and he or she should have to take an affirmative and specific action to accept any sort of change to the contract. And if that doesn't happen, then the contract shouldn't be changed. That's our point of view.
Okay, any questions? The Attorney General's office. Representative Junkie.
Well, just a comment. I pointed at Gunther because I thought that maybe answered your question. You were wondering how do they cover the costs once they're in and opt out, and that was a good question. But if they can't ever start it until Representative Vandenberg, they check on the Internet or send back the piece of paper, I would think that would be a better way to go about it. Wouldn't you agree as the author?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Vandenberg.
Maybe I'm not clear on it. It appears to me that requiring an affirmative response is amended here, that you are opting in. You're agreeing to the contract in an affirmative manner. I think what the AG's office is referring to is if there's a change after the contract has been made. And Representative Gunther's issue was a little bit different, but I thought, I'm trying to follow.
Mr.
This.
Chair, and maybe to counsel at the table, is this an opt-in or an opt-out type of situation? That's the way it's written. And I know you didn't write it. The guy that wrote it's in the audience. We already referred to him. But is it what the Attorney General just said? Representative Vandenberg seems to think it is, that you do have to take an affirmative action before the service ever begins. And my concern would be, like Representative Gunther's, that you call and say, yes, I want to take this service, and it begins the next day. Now the stuff comes in the mail, and now you decide you don't want it, and 2 weeks later you send it back, but the expenditures have already been made by the company. So what does this actually say?
Mr. Hilop, do you have any? And I don't mean to put you on the spot, so you can plead ignorant if you want.
In this case, I think I will, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we need to get that straightened out because I do. That's maybe. I think it's the way you want your bill. Too.
Well, maybe the department, Mr. Bull, could come down and give us.
Explain what the heck he did, Mr.
Who wrote?
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure that if we're splitting hairs over this or not, but it would seem, Representative Junkie, that we could have both, in that if you had acted affirmatively, let's say on a phone solicitation, and the company wanted to go ahead and start it the next day, it would be at the company's risk until the paperwork was returned. If you then received the paperwork a week later, you looked it over and you thought, no, you know, that isn't the way I understood it that night, and you either send it back as a no or don't send it back as a signed agreement, then the company basically has no signed agreement at that point or whatever, and it would be at their risk. So I think we maybe could do both.
Why don't we have Mr. Bull introduce himself for the committee, and I guess feel free to give us any insight that you see as a former drafter and from the department's perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Mike Bull from the Department of Commerce. And on this specific issue about opt-in versus opt-out, the way when I drafted the bill, I was sitting where Bob is sitting now, and the request from the author was to try to find a middle ground between the current situation where the customer doesn't have these kinds of rights, and the, that was proposed by, I think, by the Attorney General, which would require an affirmative act for the customer to agree to the change. So the way the bill is drafted is that it's a, it would be a middle ground approach, so that it gives a, there's a notice to the customer that the that this change could affect their bill, increase their bill. There's a period of time where the customer can consider that and then decide whether or not that's a change that they're willing to accept.
And Mr. Bull, if they don't then accept it in that period of time, then they opt in, or it's
they need to
take an action to opt out if they don't agree with the terms, but they have a period of time to opt out.
Right. Mr. Chair, that's correct, and that's the way the mechanics of the bill operate currently.
We're currently, if they agreed to the terms, they wouldn't have a period of two weeks or a month or whatever to say that isn't what we agreed to and change their plan. Representative Vanderveer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that was the intent, and it is because some of the members have concerns that this become cumbersome, and our goal was that it not become cumbersome, that you can affirm that you have that you've seen a contract, you understand you're entering into a long-term agreement, and that if the provider changed that agreement substantially, you could get out. It's intended to be that simple and to be, you know, to work in a smooth way that isn't overly cumbersome or expensive to the provider.
Okay. Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bull, is it the way the bill is written, is it your intent then that if you signed up for a service, let's say it was call forwarding or call waiting, whatever you want on a phone, and you had this period of time where you had to react to it, if the company started it up right away, whose risk is and then you decided during that period of time that you didn't want it, whose risk is for the service that's been turned on right away?
Mr. Bull, do you have an answer to that?
Well, Mr. Chair, just looking at the language, I think that it would behoove the company to wait until this notice period is passed, unless they get some action from the company.
I was hoping you would say that. Thank you. That's how I determined to review it too.
But, Mr. Bull, on that point, we're not. I mean, the company's still going to get to charge for what they were charging for before. I mean, they aren't going to be providing service during that waiting period free, and the customer can't use that as a way to get out of paying part of their bill, is it?
Mr. Chair, that's how I read the bill. That it's sort of a notice by the customer, by the company, that they're going to make this change to the contract in 60 days unless they hear from the customer. And that during that 60-day period, everything stays the same as before the 60-day period, and that the change should occur after that.
But they're going to get paid for the 60 days like they were getting paid prior to that.
That's correct. That's how I read the bill.
Yeah, Representative Junkie.
Another question, Mr. Chair, to Representative Vanderveer. Maybe some of the confusion. Is this just for changes in your current service? What if a telemarketer calls me, which I do get, even though we're not supposed to get them anymore, but we get those calls. What if they call me and I agree to a new service? But I, at that point, I didn't understand. I just signed up for a two-year contract either. Does this apply to that, too, or is it just existing contracts?
And if it is just existing, why wouldn't we do it for all those types of transactions on the phone, whether it's new service or existing?
Representative Vanderveer.
Mr. Chair, I think this would apply whenever you're entering into a new contract, which your provider would tell you, say they telemarketed you and said, you've got this plan, we think this plan would work better for you. You go, oh, really? Yeah, that is cheaper. Okay, I'll take it. At that juncture, typically they, from my experience and from what I've heard, they don't tell you that you just entered into another 2-year or 1-year contract.
And, Mr. Chair, I guess the confusion is just reading the language, because it always talks about a change in the contract between the provider and the customer. But what if I have a new contract? I'm not changing it. It's brand spanking new. Quest is sitting here. Quest called me and wants me to sign up on their cell service. It's a brand new. Dump Midwest at Gunther had sign up for Quest. And I say, okay, I'll do it. And so now, you know.
Okay. Mr. Ball translated your question for me. That is a new service. And
yep.
So that's going forward. So the portion of the contract of the bill that requires that you get a copy of the contract and affirm that you understand it and seen it and agree to it would apply.
So that applies to new also.
Yeah, now you'd still have the other provider you'd have to get rid of because you're changing service. So there's where your termination, early termination fee could apply or whatever.
And Mr.
Representative Junk.
Mr. Bull, why did you pick the commission rather than the commissioner when you wrote it up?
He didn't work for him then.
I was waiting for an offer from the commission.
Mr. Bold.
Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, that was actually a choice by the officer.
Okay.
But he had a strong preference.
On that point, Representative Vanderveer, let's say I don't even have cell service and I just start a new service. You're saying the new company would have to just give me a contract, and would I have a period of time then to get out of that 1 or 2 year contract that's a brand new service? And if so, I'm still going to have to pay for startup costs and month or 40 days of service that I had before I backed out, aren't I?
Well, Mr. Chair, my intent, maybe Mr. Ball could clarify that, or is that if you entered into a new contract and you indicated in an affirmative manner by signing or otherwise that you agreed to the terms of it, that contract would apply then right away. It's dealing with the changes in an existing contract that these 60 days would apply. That is my intent.
Okay.
The point at which you enter the contract, and I think you have the 15 days in the bill to the company would have 15 days to get your affirmative response. After that, you would have a contract. It would be my intent. But if they then came back and the company changed the terms of the contract, then the 60 days opt-in would apply, or opt-out would apply.
Okay. So are we getting rid of the ability of me to call up a cell phone company and order a service over the phone and be done with it? I mean, I don't want to have to hassle all this paperwork necessarily. I might want service. They can FedEx it over to me to overnight. I'll have the phone tomorrow, and they've done that before for me. So is that going to be stymied now, or is that still going to be a practice that they can go on? And maybe it's a question that providers that may testify could answer.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure they'll tell you won't be able to do that anymore. But the reality is I signed up and affirmatively indicated I agreed with one of the carriers on the web, just clicking the buttons and sending it back in. Your FedEx package could come out, you could sign it, fax it in when you activate your phone, and you could have the service. I mean, you know, asking for you to just simply affirm in one, or they could record you on the phone and give you the phone, which is what I think AT&T does. Any of those things would work the same way as they're doing it now. They would just, some of them have to keep a record. In my case, I asked Verizon, do you have anything that shows I entered into a contract to remind me or show me? No. So that's all we're saying is that you have a, if you're going to hold somebody to a contract, you have some documentation that shows their verification that they agreed to it. That's all we're saying.
With that, Mr. Bull, any other comments from the departments? Oh, he's gone. Any other testifiers? Oh, Representative Osmond.
I have a question, Representative Vandeveer, so I'm trying to understand the implications of this. Are, with my cell phone at the current time, can my provider send me a notice saying that they have increased my level of service and therefore my charges are going to go up, and then if, then it's going to be up to me to tell them no before they can do that underneath your provision?
Mr. Representative Vandeveer.
No, you can't tell them they can't do that, but they, you can tell them that you no longer have to pay an early termination fee if you decide to go somewhere else. It, in other words, if they tell you you bought 1,000 minutes for $100 and now tell you the 1,000 minutes costs $150, they can't tell you that you have to stay there for the year or two that you have previously agreed to. If they unilaterally change the contract, you can get out of your end of the contract.
But, Representative Vandeveer, they can't just sell you 1,000 minutes for 12 a month for $100 and then for 12 months and then 6 months into the contract say we're going to change our price to $150.
Mr. Chair, we agree, but unfortunately that's a personal experience. They take similar action, not with the minutes, but in my case it was call forwarding where the car phone was forwarded to the office. If you called me on my cell phone and the call came into my office, at that point you quit paying for the time. They did that for 20 years, and then they sent out a notice that said from now on you're going to pay the whole duration of the call. So you wouldn't even know if the call came through call forwarding and you sit and chat with me for a half hour and get billed for 30 minutes. That's a substantial change in the service provided. And then tell you not only that, but you have to stay here for 2 years. So they, that's what this is referring to. If you make substantial changes in the contract or the service provided that will result in additional costs to the customer, then the customer has the option of changing plans or leaving the company.
Okay, with that, let's open it up to any other testifiers. Is there anybody else?
Mr. Chair, while they're coming down.
Yeah, Representative Osmond.
Okay, Mr. Chair, while the testifiers are coming down, I'm wondering, Representative Vandeveer, if that situation happens and they change the service, they can do that without any notification to you at all? They didn't let you know that they were going to do that?
Mr. Chair, they Representative Osmond, they sent out a notice at which time I called and said, well, I'm going to have to cancel the service, and they said, well, you can't. They said,
no wonder we had this legislation before.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Junkie.
Which company was that? My contract's up next month.
I'm sorry, Courtney. It was Verizon.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
They'd have to go to the bottom of the lake to get that employee.
they're lined up in support, Mr. Chair.
They're behind you. Way behind. No. Scott Berg, why don't you go first? Is there anybody else from out of town? If you are, let us know and we can let you first. Mr. Berg, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is Scott Bergs. I am the Vice President of Legal and Regulatory Affairs for Midwest Wireless Communications. Midwest Wireless is a Minnesota-based company based in Mankato, where it was originated back in 1990. We employ about 300, or a little over 300 people within the state of Minnesota, and over 500 people total throughout our service area, which expands into Iowa and western Wisconsin. We serve almost exclusively rural areas in each of those three states, with the slight exception of the Rochester Metropolitan Service Area. Midwest Wireless, within that service territory, has been successful in expanding both its service territory, or its coverage, ability to reach customers, and also its service offerings, in addition to the number of customers that it serves throughout that area, principally because of its willingness and dedication to three core values. The first is customer focus. We care. The second is a commitment to quality. Your service works. And the third is continuous innovation. Better ways, always. With regard to that first core value, we demonstrate that by dedicating that for each new service that we activate, a customer is provided 30 days after the latter of the period when they signed up or the period of their first bill. I'm sorry, 30 days from the time that they sign up or upon receipt of their first bill, they may terminate their service without termination fee for any or no reason at all. We have not revised any contracts under any circumstances without giving the customer the ability to grandfather or maintain their existing terms of service. If we were to make a mandatory adverse revision, we have pledged, as have most if not all of the other wireless carriers that operate in the state of Minnesota, to allow affected customers to terminate without penalty pursuant to the CTIA Consumer Code. We have a commitment to quality. We currently have, within the state of Minnesota, 156 active cell sites. Over the last 5 years, we have increased that number by 79, or over 50%. By deploying those number of towers throughout our service territory, we are also able to add an additional service, Clearwave Wireless, a wireless Wi-Fi broadband service, which is deployed throughout much of our service territory in Minnesota and northern Iowa. By deploying that service, we were recognized by Governor Pawlenty's Commissioner of Economic Employment and Economic Development as a model for rural economic development. With regard to continuous innovation, in addition to the benefits of being able to provide Wi-Fi wireless broadband access, we are also able to provide a service called CDMA 1XRTT, which the next generation of which is EVDO, or both of which are data services that can be provided directly through the phone or through a wireless air card, which can be plugged into a laptop. And I can pass this around if there's interest by the different commissioners or representatives. In addition, on the issue of continuous innovation, we have deployed in-house, as well as acquiring third-party applications that we've deployed to our customers, including SMS service, short message service, MMS or multimedia services, Brew applications, which allow users or subscribers to download various different games, tools and utilities, and other applications down to their phone. And we also created an SMS pull account management system in-house that allows customers to review how many minutes they've used during a particular month, how many minutes are left on their package, and other data about their account on a real-time basis anytime during the month. There's a reason why we have taken all of these measures, and there's a reason why that has resulted in the kind of success that Midwest has enjoyed over the years. And that is because we operate in one of the most highly competitive marketplaces in the United States today. In most of our service territory, we compete with over 3 to 8 wireless carriers in addition to wireline carriers who are competing for that customer's communication services. We also compete with cable companies who are entering into the communications field, as well as many other providers that you've heard about over the last couple of days of hearings before this committee who are providing voice over IP and other services for communication. This competitive marketplace has not only yielded the types of additional services that Midwest Wireless is able to provide to its customers, but it's also yielded an 80% reduction in prices nationwide for wireless services over the last 8 years. The simple answer is that the deregulatory framework, which was created by the FCC in the 1993 Omnibus Act, and which was implemented by the FCC, I'm sorry, was created by Congress and implemented by the FCC ever since that period of time, has created enormous benefits, even beyond what they originally projected, which was ubiquitous service provided by many different carriers within a particular area. If 1692 were put into place, it would have some negative results for consumers. It would result in higher rates for a couple of different reasons. Number one, as you've heard, wireless carriers routinely have termination fees for customers who enter into contracts and who choose to terminate those contracts before the end of the term of those contracts. The reason for those termination fees, and in fact the measure of those termination fees in almost every case, corresponds to the discount that is provided to that customer for the phone equipment that they've provided. That the cellular provider has furnished. If our ability to recover those sunk costs or cost per gross add goes away and customers are given the ability to ignore consumer contracts, we will simply be unable to provide that benefit to customers. In addition, there will be higher monthly fees due to higher administrative costs for tracking the types of actions that are going on, but maybe more importantly, I think there is an area of agreement here, and that is I don't think that there would be a large additional cost for a carrier to provide a service contract upon request. And in fact, we certainly abide by that. I'm a customer of Sprint, and Sprint, upon my request, provided me my contract. And to my knowledge, there are no wireless carriers who, upon request, will not provide you a copy of their contract. I'm also a lawyer, and I guess if somebody didn't provide a copy of a contract or wasn't able to provide evidence that a contract existed, it would also be my opinion that there is not a contract, or at least that that contract would not be enforceable by the party with the burden of proving that there is. But in a case where a contract does exist, the wireless carrier's requirement to defend actions, whether or not they have any real justification, will eclipse the proposed penalties which are identified in the bill. Having to go to the Public Utilities Commission and defend consumer actions will not only tax the Public Utilities Commission, I believe as Representative Junkie mentioned, it will also tax heavily those carriers who are forced to go before the Commission and not only pay for their own defense costs, but in accordance with the Public Utilities Commission rules, pay for Department of Commerce counsel fees and administrative staff fees and those of the Public Utilities Commission. Those are costs which the carriers will bear, but will ultimately show up on a customer's bill, not as a line item, but on increased costs. The 80% reductions which the customers have enjoyed over the last 8 years will disappear. There will be inconvenience suffered by customers because currently online contracts are becoming an increasing trend within the industry. In addition to the existing telephone activations and having customers come in and utilize simple one-page forms similar to Midwest Wireless one-page consumer contract. Instead, as I understand the proposed legislation, carriers would be required to detail every aspect of the customer relationship, which would ultimately lead to many pages of forms, rather than allowing a customer to choose a rate plan and then with the opportunity to change from one rate plan to another. It would also limit network improvements and service advancements. Again, every dollar that is spent paying for Department of Commerce administrative fees or paying for a wireless carrier's own defense costs for valid or baseless claims by a consumer cannot be spent to further deploy the network. In our case, our ability to build out 79 new cell sites in the last 5 years. The administrative costs of this bill, while they may seem easy on their face, and while this bill may seem simple in concept, will be enormous on the carriers and will be very burdensome to consumers. Wireless carriers want to prevent bad business practices. Wireless carriers are currently incented to make sure that other wireless carriers abide by their proclaimed practices. The CTIA Code of Conduct, as I mentioned earlier, and a copy of which I have given to the page to be provided to each of you, provides several consumer rights. It was initiated in 2002. Most carriers opted in between 2002 and 2003, and there are still carriers who are reviewing and deciding whether or not to opt into that provision. The key there is that the implementation for most carriers is not complete. Certainly speaking on behalf of Midwest Wireless, the implementation is not complete. While our contract procedures have always mirrored the code of conduct, our customer service representatives, we simply have not had time to train them on the specifics of what it means to comply with the CTIA code of conduct. It is very possible that if someone called a Midwest Wireless customer service representative and asked them about a specific provision of the CTIA code of conduct, they wouldn't get the answer that they wanted. I hope that that's not the case, but it's possible because training is ongoing. And my suspicion is that other carriers are experiencing the same thing. The kinds of protections that are included in the CTIA code of conduct, I'll just highlight two of them because they are representative of what's in this proposed bill. The first is that all carriers must offer to consumers upon new contracts the ability to get out of that contract within 15 days of the initiation of that service. The second is that upon a material adverse change, and I'll make that distinction from the bill that's before you today, because if there were a positive change, we as an industry, and certainly we as Midwest Wireless, do not feel that that should entitle a customer to a right to rescind the contract. But if there is a material adverse change to the contract, that the customer is given, again, an additional period of time to opt out of that contract change. Those protections exist today. They are in various forms of implementation, but they exist today. There is an annual certification program being implemented by the CTIA to enforce the provisions of that program and to ensure that all carriers who profess to comply with those provisions do in fact comply with those provisions. The fact of the matter is this bill is simply unnecessary. In a world where each market has multiple competitors and in a world where a customer now has the right to take their number with them when they move to another carrier, or to be completely accurate, in the rural areas of Minnesota, where Midwest principally operates, as of May 24th of this year, customers will have the right to take their number with them. We simply, as carriers, cannot afford to have customers angry and upset with us. If a customer leaves us in our highly competitive marketplace, we hope to get them back. We cannot afford to have them leave us with such distaste and such disdain that we have no chance of getting them back. Customer service offers carriers, especially carriers like Midwest, a distinct competitive advantage, and we do not want to have that competitive advantage taken away. One of the issues that I understand Representative Vanderveer has with the existing CTIA Code of Conduct is that there is no, in fact, remedy available to consumers. They just have no place to go to enforce their rights. And I disagree with that statement. The first remedy that's available to them is the FCC. The FCC has a website. The FCC has email access. The FCC has a toll-free number, 1-888-CALL-FCC. And the FCC has a fax number, All of those numbers are available on the FCC website and can be reached through directory assistance in order to file a complaint with the FCC for a carrier's illegal practices.
Mr. Berg?
Yeah.
We're running out of time here, so if you can help try to condense your final points. It's just about 4:15 when we have to adjourn. And Representative Vandiver, did you have a question or comment?
No.
Mr. Chair, I can wait until.
Okay.
No.
But, can you? Mr. Berg, how much testimony do you have left?
Very small amount, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
A couple of the other remedies that are available to customers today are the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, and the State Attorney General's Office. And the reason that I say that is if a carrier claims to comply with the CTIA Code of Conduct, advertises that compliance, makes that a part of their marketing practices, and then does not comply, that is, in our opinion, a violation of the FTC Act as well as a violation of the Minnesota State Deceptive Trade Practices Act, both of which have enforcement opportunities. We think that those are superior enforcement opportunities to resort to the Public Utilities Commission because most consumers think of consumer complaints being handled by the Attorney General's Office or the Federal Trade Commission, whereas most of them do not know what the Public Utilities Commission even is. My final point is that this bill unfairly targets wireless carriers in this industry. It does not address service contracts for consumers in any way, and yet there's nothing unique about the kinds of contracts that wireless carriers enter into that make it distinct from lawn care service, appliance service, cable service, satellite television service, or a host of other consumer-based services that are provided in the marketplace today. I believe, as a very final point, I believe that if a change is made to a contract in violation of state law, a consumer is not bound by that change in that attempted to change the contract. Therefore, as Representative Vandiver described his concern with his wireless carrier, I just simply do not believe that that's an enforceable revision to the contract. And Representative Vandiver was perfectly free to not abide by that change in the contract. If, in fact, there was a report to our credit bureau that did not identify that it was a disputed charge, Representative Vandiver has a remedy directly to the Federal Trade Commission. Those remedies exist today. Additional regulation of this type would be duplicative, if not preempted under federal law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Representative Vandiver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a card? I would talk to you about cell phone service. Sound like a good company, but real quickly, the early termination fees would not go away. We're just saying if you change the contract unilaterally, you couldn't hold them to the fees. So that's just not an issue. But with regard to the industry code of ethics, your company might have the best of intentions. But one of the lobbyists dropped off those code of ethics at my office, so I picked them up and I called Verizon. And I said, relating to the change in the contract, and I said, well, what options do I have other than to pay you? Oh, you can pay us, or you can pay the collection agency. Well, what appeals do I have? To the collection agency, and if I don't pay, well, it's not good for your credit, Mr. Vandiver. And by then it was Representative Vandiver because I even told them that I was going to go to committee with this, and I was just calling on the code of ethics to see if things had changed. So it doesn't work that way. And, you know, with the best of intentions, I think a contract is all we're asking for. If you change the terms of the contract unilaterally, the customer is no longer bound. Very simple and very basic.
Okay. Mr. Berg and then members, we're going to end up holding this over, so just for your information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. I believe that if a carrier, again, in the situation that Representative Vandiver mentioned, if a carrier reports a matter to collections and then it is reported to a credit bureau, there is a remedy. There are consumer protections already in place under the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act that protect that process. For a state to legislate that process or for a state to create unique contracting principles for an interstate service would create a patchwork of regulation that will make it difficult, if not impossible, for wireless carriers to provide service at the rates that they're doing so today.
Mr. Berg, for your information, you sound like there's a system in place, but I can tell you from firsthand experience as well, someone I know fairly well in my district dealt with getting a bill that they actually ended up paying twice to Verizon because they would not remove it from their credit report, and they finally ended up paying it a second time just to get it off. And so, and that was over a 6 to 8 year period. So it's not that simple of a process as you make it sound. So,
oh, Representative Westrum, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make it sound like it's a simple process, but there is a remedy available. And if that remedy is ineffective, my recommendation would be fix that remedy. That's a credit reporting issue. It is not a wireless carrier specific contracting issue.
Mr. Chair, one of the lobbyists told me that your constituent could always get a lawyer.
Representative Osmond, and then we need to
Mr. Chair, just
wrap
one,
this up.
One question for Mr. Berg. With regard to your customer service people and or your salespeople, do they work on commission and or bonuses based upon new contracts or renewal contracts?
Mr. Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. Our customer service representatives do not. Our direct sales representatives who would sell to major accounts are on a commission-based system, and our sales representatives that work at the retail store are not on a commission-based system, but they are. There are rewards and bonuses for reaching targets over a period of time.
Mr. Chair and Representative Berg, if I call up your customer service and I have some concern and they give me a new service, they talk me into extending something, don't they get a bonus for that or any type of commission?
Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we don't have a bonus system for our customer service representatives.
All right, that's good.
So, members, with that, time is out. To the audience, we will hold this over until tomorrow. It may be second or third on the agenda. We'll try to deal with Representative Cox's bill, 995, first. But with that, we'll hold this over. And let me encourage the groups that had comments, the AG's office, the opponents, to get together. And there's obvious some problems and some language issues. Bring back some fixes, because I don't see this bill moving out of here very fast, the way it's written exactly. There is a concern, but try to work these things out before tomorrow. Meeting adjourned.